I'm going up the country. Don't you want to go? Gonna leave this city. Got to get away. All this fussing and fighting, man, you know I sure can't stay. That, from Canned Heat, leads us to ask, can we get away by going back to the country? Or is the country now forbidden us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,079th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Todos Santos who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's an honor to roll with.
Jason, have you ever dreamt about shucking it all and moving off to the country where you could, where the water tastes like wine?
Shuck, yeah.
I guess perhaps we all have. Well, folks, remember that stuff from Canned Heat? Going up the country? Don't you want to go? Gotta leave this city? Get rid of all this fussing and fighting? I guess of a dream shared by many. Canned Heat came back to mind when Joel Salatin pointed the way to the independent farmstead as a potential subject for a Food Chain radio show. I thought, that's the book I was supposed to write, but wrote Metro Farm instead. Misdirection, I reckon. And speaking of direction, there seems to be two of them leading to the future of food. One of them comes compliments of our ability to use chemicals, tools, and modern technologies, and points in the direction of industrial-scale farms producing vast amounts of commodities with very few people. Some, like Elon Musk, go so far as to say people will no longer be required in the workforce, that machines and chemicals will do all the work, and everyone will receive a universal basic income for being human, and then shoot off the stage to enjoy their free time. The other direction comes compliments of our ability to cooperate with nature in ways that amplify the natural productivity of animal and plant crops, and points in the direction of a countryside filled with people on small farms, producing clean, nutrient-dense foods. Some, like Jill Salatin, say that our ability to work with the earth will turn our countryside back into the verdant paradise of nature it once was, and will turn us, we the people, back into the independent, strong, God-fearing people we once were. In looking around, we see Elon Musk's vision predominating, with 95 million working-age adults, one-third of the population, now out of work and collecting their universal basic income. But when we see how the folks are enjoying their free time, we see idle hands becoming the devil's workshop, and we shudder at the future. So today we turn and look in the direction Joel Salatin points and ask, can we go back to the country? Or is it now forbidden us? Here to help us, we have Sean and Beth Doherty. They are the co-authors of The Independent Farmstead. Sean and Beth, welcome aboard. Well, we have Sean and Beth Doherty. I hope you can hear us. We will pick you up in just a minute here. Sean and Beth are the co-authors of a beautiful book I have in my hand, The Independent Farmstead. Growing soil, biodiversity, and nutrient-dense food with grass-fed animals and intensive pasture management. Sean and Beth took a little piece of land and started their own farm. Oh boy, here comes the engineer. Maybe we'll get rescued. And so today we're going to look at them and see what we can do to learn from their experience, which must have been amazing, don't you think? Going back to the country with nothing in your hands, but your willingness to find a way and start a farm. So that's what we're going to learn today as soon as we pull up the phones here somehow. I'm going to put them on hold here. Maybe we can, our engineers can pull us out of this. Well, as I said in the introduction, as we're waiting to pick up our guests, this book, The Independent Farmstead, was the book I was supposed to write when given the assignment by publisher Nancy Tappan up there in Rogue River, Oregon, back when I was working for NBC Television. And we were doing a piece on survivalists, which were essentially people who go away from the country or go away from the city, hunker down in the country, and try to make a go of it. Think we have somebody now?
Hi, Michael. Are you there?
Hey, bingo.
Very good.
We got it. Our engineers pulled us out of the soup there.
Wonderful.
Thank you, engineers.
Yeah, always right. So I was telling the story of how your book was the most book I was supposed to write. and I got the assignment when I was working on a story for NBC Magazine on survivalists.
Mm-hmm.
And we were up in Southern Oregon, and we were doing an establishing shot. You know, beyond, you could see the Rogue Valley. This is where the survivalists hang out. And down in this beautiful valley, there were all of these beautiful ranchettes, but nobody was growing anything. And, you know, as a Montana farm boy, I just instinctively turned to our guide and said, Nancy, we should make a pamphlet on ways to make money with those small parcels of land. And she said, wonderful idea. And 2 months later, I got a call from her, and she said, I sold your book. and so I went on my adventure. But my adventure led me to a very interesting statistic in the Census of Agriculture, whereas the average acre of farmland in Iowa was making 300 and some bucks a year. The average acre of farmland in the city limits of San Francisco was making somewhere in the neighborhood of $70,000 per
wow.
year. So, you know, that statistic really changed my direction, and I failed in my mission to the publisher, but it came out with Metro Farm. But when I saw your book and Joel pointed me to your book, I thought, wow, this, what a great opportunity, because this is the book I was supposed to write. And so welcome to the food chain.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Okay. Are you married?
Yes, we are.
You're married.
Yeah.
Now,
eight children's worth of marriage.
Wow. I always say the secret to a long marriage is learning how to fight.
Oh, well, we managed to do a little bit of that.
But you learned how to fight, right?
Yes, that's right. Very carefully.
Very carefully. And, you know, a farm is a living enterprise. And in some respects, it's like unconditional warfare that goes on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to learn how to work together. How did you learn how to work together?
Well, the farm has been great fun. Beth and I have always loved to work together. When we were in college at the same time. I was a senior and she was a freshman.
Where at?
At University of Dallas in Irving, Texas.
Okay, so you're city folks then.
Well, yeah. We both grew up. We were weekend farmers in Oklahoma, and then Beth grew up in Houston where her dad did.
I grew up outside of Houston where my dad did a ranch. But both our dads were actually medical professionals with a yen for the farm they'd grown up.
Okay, good. Good. So you had a little bit of both worlds in both of you then.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. City schools, country home.
Uh huh. And what made you take the leap?
We had always, the leap of marriage or the leap of farming?
I guess they're both, right?
Yeah,
they kind of go together, right?
I just got smart and found the right girl.
Uh-huh.
The leap of farming, we had always wanted to do it, even as we, when we were in college and dating and things like that, we were always members of a community of wonderful folks. And farming was something that we knew that we wanted to do. We wanted to live rurally. And when we came out here to Steubenville, Ohio, I taught at Franciscan University for 25 years.
Oh, okay.
And so we had a place in the city, and we were longing to get out to the country, and finally found a broken down piece of land with a broken down house on it, but it got us out of the city, and we thought, well, we'll just buy this place. It was very cheap, and then we'll figure out some things, and we'll go on to real farming. And we've been here for 20 years now, and it has grown on us, and we have learned how to farm trash land. And that's
Ooh.
What we're excited about, is how do you take land that you can't do anything else with and turn it into a farm?
Well, this is going to be very exciting. We always like to ask our guests the single most important question ever, which is, who pays the way for you? Does your farm pay the way? Do you get a grant from Monsanto?
Oh.
One thing that that's been really an important part of our lifestyle is being able to live on one income. So I have always worked, and so for 25 years I taught at Franciscan University, and that paved the way. And then in the last few years, the farming has grown bigger and bigger.
Okay, and that's what we needed to know. Right back with Trash Land Farming.
Yes.
And you,
yes.
Do stay tuned.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Welcome back, folks. Today we're going back to the country. You know, we're going to shuck this city. We're tired of all the fighting and scrapping going on in the city. We're going to go look for some independence, and we're going to do so with Sean and Beth Doherty, the co-authors of The Independent Farmstead and the proprietors of what's the name of your farm?
The Sow's Ear.
The Sow's Ear Farm.
People ask us about that one a lot. I guess it's not a saying everybody knows. You can't make a silk purse out of a
sow's ear. There you go. But you did, didn't you?
No, it's just a really good sow's ear.
Okay, good. Why do people want to go back to the land? Why did you want to go back to the land? What was it? What was it that was not working for your? I mean, two college graduates living in the city. What was it that was drawing you back to the land?
That's a good question, and it goes back to when we were, you know, when we were young. We always enjoyed being in the country. Both of us are grandchildren of, you know, poor dry farmers from the Southwest. The home farm was always available, you know, on the weekends and for holidays. And it was something we always wanted without ever having a sense that it was available. I don't know how it is for other people, but I always heard, and I know Sean always heard, both from our parents and just from the way we were educated, you can't farm anymore. The small farm, that lifestyle is no longer available.
Which is, you know, that's the second half of my question of the day. Is the country now forbidden us?
It's kind of astonishing, isn't it, to think that that's something we're led to believe.
Yeah. So what, you know, you heard that a million times like everybody else, and yet you thought, to heck with it, right? We're going.
I think that we're pigheaded and determined. And we did not set out with a goal of getting to where we are now. I don't think we had a real clear picture, except we knew we wanted to live in the country, and we knew we wanted to grow food. So we did that. And in the course of doing that, we discovered a lot of things about the methods that are available in, you know, lots and lots and lots of magazines and how-to books today.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, how do you keep chickens in your backyard, or how do you raise a pig, or how do you garden? And we realized as we followed those methods that they weren't really answering. They didn't really answer.
Basic question. Let me ask you this. What do people find when they do what you did, which is shuck it all and go back to the country?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that if in your journey back to the country, you follow the model of the commercial farm on miniature, I think maybe you may not find what we have found. And what we did was we tried to follow the model of our grandfathers. And what did people do before feed stores? And what we have found is that the day is, you know, you milk at certain times during the day. The day, nature begins to form and shape our lives rather than us shaping nature's life.
So what you're saying is that if you go back to the country and adopt the modern technologies that are essentially based on economies of scale, mm-hmm. without those economies of scale, kind of a duck out of water.
Yeah, we get contacted by people pretty frequently who say, I don't know how you raise food in the country. It costs too much to raise that food.
Explain that, please.
They'll trot out to us videos that they've seen or books that they've read. That a classic example is somebody saying, you know, how keeping one milk cow can't possibly be cost effective because a milking machine costs so much. Right. You laugh because you know your two hands are your milking machine. But over and over, people set out to keep chickens or raise a garden and find themselves using materials and methods that, as you say, are taken from an economy of scale. And they don't work very well. They're not very cost effective on a small scale.
I mean, our dairy cow, once we have purchased the cow, it no longer costs us anything. Because we are on grass all year round. We may have.
You mean you're not going to the feed store and buying grain?
Nope, we don't. I mean, we give our cow a little bit of grain, some of the cows, a little bit of grain to bring them in. But the cows that we have had, that we have raised, they don't even want the grain. They're happy to come into the stall, be milked, and so there is no more cost to us unless something goes wrong, we have to have a vet or something like that. But that was a real shift for us to think, wait a minute, all those things that people said you have to do, you can't raise cattle on grass alone. Of course you can. And other things that were, that's why people say you couldn't farm anymore, because nobody was farming the way people used to farm.
Something tells me you made an existential discovery along the lines that you looked at what everybody says to do, or what all the books said to do, how to feed, how to do all of this, and you discovered that this can't possibly work for the scale we're working with. You shucked it, right?
Right.
And what was it that you really came to discover?
Well,
about grass, maybe?
Yeah, our little farm took several steps to get there. It was when we realized that the ruminant on grass is the means for mankind to turn most of the solar capture on the habitable part of the globe into food, that our farm could sort of unplug and become the independent farmstead. Ruminants on grass are the means that we turn most solar energy into food.
Let's go back to grass and start with grass. Mm-hmm. I think because before you could have the ruminants, you know, unless you're feeding them grain, you have to have the grass. What is it about grass that we kind of lost track of here in our modern thinking, in our technology-centered world? What is it about grass? What's the magic of grass?
Well, first of all, it's the biggest solar collector. It's a permaculture. It covers most of the land mass of the habitable parts of the globe. Not most, as in more than 50%, but more than any other single biosphere, more than any other single plant type. Grass is going to be the biggest solar collector. It also, this carries us to the question that I first encountered, because it never occurred to me, reading and listening to Michael Pollan, which is the zero-sum question of mankind's habitation on the globe. Must we live here and only take away by our needs? Do we just subtract from the goods available on the globe? Grass management is, good grass management, is a system whereby as we take out, we build up a bigger bank of fertility, a bigger bank of drought and flood resistance in the soil. So we improve it as we use it.
We've been floored with the area. I mean, again, we started on this trashed farm, and the pasture that we are having now after a few years of intense rotational grazing is amazing.
I have to stop and interrupt, Sean. We use words like farm and pasture about our place. We're really in a little tiny east-west steep holler of the foothills of Appalachia. Nobody would ever have called it a farm or any part of it a pasture before we began using it.
So we're going to have to take a quick break. Mm-hmm. But when we get back, I'd like you to tell us how you took this trash land and turned it into the verdant paradise of nature that brings forth food and family and everything that we really are looking for when we think about running away from the city. And you found it, but it was via the grass. And how did you use grass to turn trash into paradise? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with the co-authors of the Independent Farmstead, Sean and Beth Doherty, and you. Now, I bet that you have dreamed about going away, shucking it all, moving out to the country. Is it possible? Or have they shut off the country from us, no longer permitting us to live out there? This is the question right back. Well, folks, been to the big city lately? Ooh, I was up in San Francisco recently. Filth, grime, and crime all over the place. And so we get the notion, the heck with this, let's shuck this big city and move to the country. Possible? Maybe, but if it, to make it possible, we kind of have to think outside the conventional box. And that box not being something you buy at the feed and seed and feed your animals, it being something else, something that's always been there for us, grass. And that's the subject today as we talk with Sean and Beth Doherty about the Independent Farmstead. Sean and Beth, tell us what your land looked like. Where is it? What did it look like when you bought it? And why was it so cheap?
Well, we live in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And
is it beautiful there?
It's just lovely, and it's mostly pretty steep. A lot of clay soil, a lot of shale underneath the soil.
Wow.
The piece of it that we bought was what was left over 75 years ago, when all the good parts of the farm were sold off. And there wasn't a whole lot anybody could do with it. There was a trailer down in here. Somebody had built a house that was in pretty dilapidated condition, but savable. And it was overgrown with briars and sumac, and it was pretty much...
All of the warning signs.
Everything to show that underneath that, what we're going to find is years and years worth of trash that people had dumped off the side of the hill, which indeed we did find. We dug out from under that with the help of a bunch of goats. We put the briars under control and began to look around us as the goats got the briars under control, and we thought maybe we could move out from goats a little. We started using what grass was available. It wasn't much. The land had been logged, then stripped of its topsoil. That was sold off the property.
The topsoil was sold off?
Yeah, the topsoil was sold off by the former owners as backfill when they put an earth-retaining wall on the county road.
Wow.
It was pretty bad down there. And it was, you know, we were sort of looking at the ground the way the conventional farmer does, is something that holds up the plant. But we weren't taking very good care of it until we ran into the concept of intensive grass management. And it was like hearing the good news of salvation preached. It was amazing. I think our imaginations were captured immediately by the notion that through the use of grazing animals, we could capture and store fertility in our soil for now and for the future. That while we were making food from the soil, we were also putting down a fund of fertility to make it possible for us to move into the future securely on that land. And that's indeed what happened.
Now, obviously, this is the way mankind has gone along on the land for millenniums. And we got lost someplace along the line, right? Something happened that turned us away from that grassland management, and we became, I guess, grain merchants, right?
Yeah, I think there's a good argument that in various times and in various places, people have failed to manage their grass well, and that the end result is environmental degradation. Today, we're in a position to do it on an enormous scale and very, very quickly. You know, what might have taken 1,000 years of overgrazing to ruin, we've been able to do very quickly with chemicals and big machines and feedlots.
So what happened with when your neighbors saw you moving into town and buying that place that nobody else wanted? I mean, did they look at you kind of like, well, here comes those silly city people. How long did they take a bets on how long you would last?
if they did, they haven't told us about it since then. But I think in the 20 years, we feel pretty good about the people who have thawed to us and then taken us into, well, I'll tell you, when the man at the local feed mill used the word us to refer to him and me one time, I thought, okay, we've arrived.
He got there.
Other people aren't like us. They're not interested in, you know, in natural gardening. And I thought, okay, I belong now.
You made it, huh? Welcome home. and so you started with goats. And, of course, why didn't you just use, like, you know, Roundup or something? I mean, there was a place where you made the decision not to go in that direction, some place in your life, right, where you thought, we're not going to go in that direction. Where was that?
Oh, gosh. I think we were always there. Sean's dad used a certain amount of Roundup under fence lines, but none of us ever thought it was a good thing. You know, the results of Roundup are always ugly. But here, we moved into, in one sense, a healthy microenvironment because the weeds were really healthy. Trees were doing pretty well. There was just a lot of trash underneath and a lot of briars on top. We wanted to get down to that soil and see what it was like down there.
Mm-hmm. And the goats helped you out.
They were terrific.
Mm-hmm. And then, what did you plant grass? Once you got down, you know?
Never.
We have thrown out some clover seed. But no, we have not gone through with tractors. We couldn't bring a tractor into this property. And we wanted to see what the natural grasses would do. And we were reading, you know, we were scanning through some of the books that modeled the commercial. But every once in a while, we'd run across the good books, the Joel Salatin books. Mm-hmm. And they would talk about let the grass, and Greg Judy on video, and let the grass do what the grass does. And that's what became our model. Let's just find out what it does. And one of the things that I think has been a good thing for us is we've tried to keep our expenses to a minimum. We do not make our, we have made some money off the land, especially we did a micro brewery, micro dairy for a while. And that has paid some. But we've always had an outside job that's helped pay the bills. But what we've tried to do with the farm is keep the expenses down and then live the lifestyle of the farm. Mm-hmm. So instead of growing these wonderful foods and meat and all this kind of stuff and then selling it, why would we sell the best food that we could ever have? So we eat all that.
So the farm essentially is not a commercial farm in the sense that you're growing crops for sale to the city. It's a independence farm in that it's allowing you to do what we all dream of, which is be independent, right?
And my goal is to eventually quit my job. And so we've sized down. I went from a tenured full-time professorship, and now I am the maintenance man for the local convent up the road, a mile and a half up the road. And we also farm, they have 50 acres up there, and so we farm that. And so I've sized down some, and eventually we're going to size down more until we are living just on the farm.
A lot of the trick to living on a farm doesn't happen when the farm makes money, but happens before that.
I want you to hold that, because can you hold that, Beth? Because that's where we'll pick up when we get back. It happens before you make the money. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, the independent farmstead, and you. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these important messages. Back to the country. Got to get away. Got to leave this city. Going to go where the water tastes like wine. Well, that's a good question. Sean and Beth, did your water taste like wine?
That's a good question. It's well water and it's good for us, which was a nice break from living in town and having to drink bottled water.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of did then, right? It had all of those minerals in it and hopefully none of the chemicals came along the way. Beth, you were talking about how it starts before the money comes in.
Yeah. When people ask us about what we do, often they're looking for a quick way to shuck the city job and become money-making farmers. And we take the same attitude that we've seen taken by people like Elliot Coleman, Joel Salatin, and Wendell Berry. The farm first needs to feed the family. To approach farming with a "this needs to make money right away" attitude is a good way to find yourself compromising the real goals you start out with for natural, chemical, free, local food, as you're trying to, you know, make budget and you have to put in a chemical insert here or take a shortcut there. For us, being able to remember, there's two of us, so that if only one of us is employed off farm, the farm is paying the other person's paycheck. In my case, the farm, my work, the time that I've had to put into the farm has helped to put the best quality dairy, meat, and vegetable products on our table and on our children's plates.
Mm-hmm. Fed the family.
Yeah.
Grew a family.
With
all due respect, it seems like that's really what farms were. I mean, that's what my grandparents' farm was. The principal crop were people.
Right.
Yeah.
And grew people.
It is definitely a family affair. In fact, just before we started this radio show, I was down with my oldest son, who has five children of his own. They weren't all there, but some of his family was there. Then several of my children were there, and we were butchering, we were doing the meat processing for two steers and a pig.
Which is a big enterprise.
It is a big enterprise. We started early this morning. Well, somebody had to milk the cow this morning. Then we started early this morning with processing meat. My children are still processing it as I took a short break. And I'll be going back to help with the processing soon.
Now, in putting out the press release for the show, I got an email from Kim Wells in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And she says, we currently have 483 acres and lease another 200. Our farm is losing money not due to lack of sales, but overabundance of permits, fees, taxes, fuel costs, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that to farm in the country for money, you must either get very, very big or somehow figure out how to be very, very small.
Yes.
Because those who are big enough to buy government have bought government and have put up a lot of obstacles to anybody else coming into the business.
Isn't mm-hmm. that the truth?
And so do you see any way around that?
I look at people like Elliot Coleman and Joel Salatin, who've come up with a combination of methods and product that allows them to adhere to their principles of farming really well and still have a product that can command a reasonable price and be able to come up with enough of it, you know, to have to be able to fill the market. They've done very well. But it is important to look around and say, who near me is going to be able to afford and is going to desire to buy these special products?
Yeah, that kind of happened to me when I was started to write Metro Farm. You know, you're up in a remote place like Rogue River, Oregon, and everybody is growing zucchini. So if you grow zucchini, good luck on selling zucchini.
Right, right.
And then same is true with homegrown tomatoes and whatnot. So the only thing that seemed to make sense to me with respect to it being really small is being in close to the city where you could, you know, move and groove really quickly and have access to the cash market, to money, and not be, you know, put upon by all kinds of rules and regulations.
Our product has been raw milk, which you can't get raw milk. Even, you know, you wouldn't want to drink the raw milk from a standard dairy. It's going through the pipes. It's got toxins and all kinds of things.
Too many chances for something to enter in, right?
That's right.
Ours
went
from the udder to the milk pail to glass, and is a great product. It's fabulous food, and
can you actually sell that?
We do a herd share. You can't sell raw milk in Ohio, so we do a herd share where people can buy in to the herd. Then they get the product from the herd.
And pay a maintenance fee every month for the care of their share of the herd.
Mm-hmm. And for that, they get the real deal.
That's right. And we set out to do that partly as an experiment to demonstrate for ourselves and our children that it is possible to create an on-farm business that would pay the bills. And we did it for long enough. We kept the herd share going for long enough that we learned a couple of things. Yes, it is. But to build up a reliable customer base is something that is going to take a little bit of time. Yeah. You know, the classic 5 years to success. In that period of time, I have no doubt that we would have had sufficient herd share co-owners that we could have lived just on the produce of.
That would have been interesting. Well, when we come back, I'm going to ask you the really big question, which was, how do we in the city go back to the country? Do stay tuned. Okay, out there, fess up. We're all tired of the filth, grime, and crime, and we're going to move to the country. We're going to move someplace and find us a little parcel of land and shuck it all and become independent and free and to heck with it all. So, who do we ask how to do that? None other than Sean and Beth Doherty, who did just that with the Independent Farmstead, a wonderfully illustrated book that you have to have if you're going to the country. So where do we start?
Well, we would say, first of all, you have to sort of revamp the ideas you have about what is a farm. If you go hunting for a farm today, a farm that looks like a farm, you'd better be a Rockefeller or you can't afford to buy it. So this country is full of little neglected, trashed, forgotten, worthless-seeming pieces of land that are just waiting for somebody to come and apply a little bit of animal energy, some goats to reduce the briars and the weeds.
You know what occurs to me that's so amazing?
What?
You let the animals do the work for you, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right. Well, modern farming looks at animals as producers. They come up with a certain product for sale. Animals have a whole variety of behaviors that are all part of the successful farm. Scratching, grazing, pecking,
cleaning, worming,
sanitation.
Right.
And using all of those as part of the success of the independent farm.
So instead of, you know, being out there with a shovel, digging and sweating, and you're kind of like the symphony conductor with all of these critters running around.
No, we're more like the symphony conductor who has the shovel and does the digging and sweating. Some of both.
But so, it's a lot of management. It's a lot of putting the animals where they need to be.
That's what I meant. You know, it's kind of like a symphony conductor, you know.
Yeah, much so. That's a great analogy.
Yeah, I constantly am looking at the farm and saying, okay, wherever this is, the woods do not need to be there. What we need to do is move these things around. So constantly seeing how can we move and adjust and put the animals in the right spot at the right time and for maximum
use of nutrients.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you get the animals to do the work. What do you do?
We get out there and work with them. We spend a lot of time milking and a lot of time moving, not very much time moving fence at each session. But
we neglected to talk about the rotational grazing. Bad, bad, bad.
Oh, okay. Well, rotational grazing is the tool that the grass farmer uses to store fertility and get nutrients out of the soil. And it's made especially easy and possible today by the use of polywire or polytwine fencing, plastic polymer fence with stainless steel filaments so that you can reel up or unreel yards and yards and yards of electric fence very quickly and easily.
So technology is good where appropriate, right?
That's right. Technology is our very good friend, or we wouldn't be talking to you on this phone right now, would we?
That's correct. So any final piece of advice for me when I'm running right out the door and getting in the car and heading for the country?
Well, we say jump in and don't just look at the commercial models. Buy our book and figure out how to do this the way Grandpa used to do it.
That's right.
Well, and for being not commercial, you did a very good commercial. Sean and Beth Doherty, thank you so much for joining us on the food page on the food chain today. Their book, The Independent Farmstead, Growing Soil Biodiversity, Nutrient-Dense Food and Grass-Fed Animals, and Intensive Pasture Management. And folks, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't. Thank you both very much, the Doherty.
Thank you, Michael.
Much, Michael.
All right. Enjoyed
it. Pleasure.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.